Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Mike Strecker, whose new comic novel is The Knights of Wade. We'll also hear from LSU professor and Kate Chopin scholar Emily Toth about the 125th anniversary of The Awakening. Mike Strecker, Assistant Vice President for News and Media Relations at Tulane University, has a pretty demanding day job, but his second life as a writer and stand-up comedian definitely has its lighter moments. He's written such books as The Young Comic's Guide to Telling Jokes, Books 1 and 2, published fiction and literary reviews, and now he's out with his first comic novel for adults, The Knights of Wade. Mike, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, this is the perfect beach book. It is so light and funny and real New Orleans. So tell us about this tale of two stepbrothers, Stuart George and Wade Terry, and how they became unlikely neighbors.
Right. Unlikely neighbors, indeed. One stepbrother, and he's very strict about that they're step and no blood relation.
Yep.
Between he and Wade, is meticulously responsible and to a fault, and Wade is meticulously irresponsible to many faults. But they're brought together by a shared inheritance that sort of forces them and their families to live together. So, like you said, there's a lot of New Orleans humor, a lot of family humor. Anyone who's been in a situation where your family, not by choice.
Right.
And who is, right? You don't choose your family.
Now, it's set in 1980s in the Navarre neighborhood. So why'd you choose
right.
that time and place?
Yeah. So the place is where I lived for, 25 years and loved that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The time was when I began writing the book. I started writing it in the late 80s, 89, I think. I completed it and sent it away and did not have any luck getting it published. I had a couple of folks say, oh, yeah, we like this, but... So I kind of put it away, and then I went on with life and started doing stand-up comedy, and I wrote some children's books. And with the success of the children's books, the publisher was like, what else do you have? I said, well, I have a novel. And actually, it was my wife. My wife met the publisher by chance at a book festival. She said, well, he has a novel. And the publisher was like, yeah, I want to see it. And I get off stage. I was presenting with my kids' books. And my wife says, we have to go home. And I said, why? And she said, you have to write that novel. So when I went back, I was going to change the time period. I was going to say, well, let me update it. But then I started reading this thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, now it's a time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to fact check anything. If there's something that's, an invention there, I don't have to, or a song that's popular, or a book, I don't have to go back and say, wait, was that really out in this time period? I know it was, and yeah, it's sort of a period piece,
mm-hmm.
not looking too far back, but far enough to give some perspective, I think.
And people who know that neighborhood will remember so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's all about comic possibility and dreams, and I love what you do with Stuart's life as a mailman. Talk about that a little bit.
and I come from a postal family.
Really?
So, yes, I do. I do. My father was a postmaster, and my several brothers and cousins and an uncle were all letter carriers, postmen. And it's an interesting and very important job, and it's a very demanding job. And you're open to attacks by dogs. You're open to snide comments from neighbors and, of course, the unrelenting heat of New Orleans summers. So, I'm glad I could pay tribute to some of the postal folks in my family by by making Stewart that, and also him having other dreams. And I guess the whole book, the big theme of the book is just hope. And
hope. Yes.
Yeah, laughing through the hard times and hoping for a better day.
Well, I really love it when you have Stewart plot revenge on a particularly vicious dog, which is a lot of fun to read.
Sir Andre, thank you.
And I love his love of uniforms.
Yes. He's not crazy about his job, but he's very enamored of his uniform. And his encounter with Sir Andre, the menacing dog on his route, is one of my favorite parts of the book.
Oh, it's fantastic. I laughed out loud.
Yeah, thank you so much. And it's the nights away, but you're right. Stewart plays a huge role in the, mm-hmm. in the comic relief.
Now, speaking of Wade doesn't have that same devotion to employment.
No.
But he does have devotion to the lottery.
Right. You know, it's so funny that the genesis of that part of the book, everybody asks you, oh, is some certain book autobiographical, and it's not, but you pull from parts of your life. And when I was in seventh grade, one of my best friends moved down from New York, and the teachers back then would always, I guess they still do, ask you, hey, what are you going to do when you get older? And sometimes it was done in a different tone. What are you going to do, you know, Mr. Stryker? And my friend would always say, Kevin Shannon is his name, he would always say he was going to win the New York lottery. And at the time, Louisiana didn't have a lottery, mm-hmm. and New York was a far-off place, and this always seemed like an exotic thing, an exotic goal. And I often thought, well, what if, as I got older, what if that was your career goal? What would your life look like?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led to a large part of the nights away.
Well, dreaming of the numbers is really a lovely reverie for us all, you know?
Isn't it? Yeah. I always love people, and I don't play the lottery. That's a funny thing, but I love to hear people's stories. They're always very specific about what they will do if they win the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep a portion. I'm going to give a portion away. I'm going to give, you know, some to this person. And I hope everybody's as generous in reality as they say when they're fantasizing about winning.
I'll never forget one of the guys at the papers after we got the lottery said, well, you know, I'm just here on a day-to-day basis now. Now, one of the other things you turn to in this book are the comic possibilities of Catholicism.
Yeah.
And so tell us about the Knights.
Yeah, so the Knights are, they're, and I've had some, after it got published, I've had some, I'm not a member of the Knights of Columbus, but I have certainly watched them from the pew, and they do great work. They really do, mm-hmm. and they're good men. But there is a comic potential in there. Whenever there's uniforms and seriousness, right?
Yeah.
And decorum and pageantry.
And a hat. Whenever there are hats.
And there are hats. And whenever there's hats involved, there's always room for comedy. And my view of the Knights, especially Stewart, is it's comedic. But I hope it's seen as loving, and
yes.
You know, and but yeah, that feeds a lot of the humor in the book.
Well, I love the way they you know are greeted as performers. Like you guys play here every night.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Oh, thank you so much. That is one of my mom has now read the book twice. God love her. And I told her the other day, I said, that's my favorite line. Do these guys play every Sunday?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mike Strecker, whose new comic novel is The Knights of Wade. You hit all the high points, which is what's so wonderful, including the renewing power of Mardi Gras.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. You know, that's a moment there where Wade is, of course, he's a natural for Mardi Gras. I mean, he's just swept up in it right away, the frivolity and just the party scene. And Stewart reluctantly goes and, you know, he's drawn into it too. And to a greater extent than he would imagine. And I've seen this happen with out-of-town guests or maybe folks here that don't like Mardi Gras, and suddenly you take them to a parade, and the next thing you know, they're going for these throws like their life depends on it. And there is a sort of transformation that happens. And yeah, it's part of the magic of Mardi Gras, right?
Oh, truly. Now, don't you find, I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, but don't you find that the real pleasure of writing comedy comes through language?
Oh, absolutely. I consider myself a writer first and foremost, mm-hmm. as opposed to a performer. Absolutely. People sometimes ask me, well, what would you rather do, you know, write or perform comedy? And I'm like, well, they're both the same thing. It's just one just emanates from the other, you know. But the play on words, it's amazing when you perform how one word, one pronunciation of a word, one inflection of a word can make all the difference in whether the joke succeeds or not. Mm-hmm. Same written material, but just a massaging of a particular word or the absence of a word sometimes is the key to the joke landing.
I have to ask you about the dedication of this book to your brother.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that meant a lot to me, and I think it meant a lot to him. My brother, Jerry, two reasons I dedicated to him. I didn't know this until much later as an adult, much, much later, that when I was a child, I had croup really bad, especially at night. It was almost bordering on asthmatic, I think.
Oh, dear.
And, and I'm the youngest of seven, and my brother Jerry is 8 years older than me. And I found out years later, my mom found out years later, that he would stand by my childhood bed. He is a young child. He mm-hmm. was like eight, probably. And he wouldn't leave until I had gone to sleep.
Oh.
And I'm kind of getting choked up talking about it, but you know, it was one of those things that someone does in secret and no one knows it. I think, you know, it's just such a sympathetic thing to have done. And then also Jerry inspired the part of the book because we kind of developed the characters of Stuart and Wade to play off of one another. And mm-hmm. when I was writing a book, I was waiting tables that night and trying to perfect my craft, home my craft as a writer during the day. And he was building an addition, a detached garage on his house. And I was helping him, you know, but I would come late to the job because I had been working the night before. And he started teasing me like I was, you know, carousing and irresponsible brother. And he cast himself as this, you know, this prince of responsibility. And I, at the time, I didn't think, oh, great ideas for characters. But I guess we had developed enough when I started writing Knights of Wade. I gravitated back to these characters and really fleshed them out.
Well, Jerry sounds like he deserves a book.
yes, indeed.
So well done.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Mike Strecker, whose new book is The Knights of Wade, and it is filled with the sights and sounds of real New Orleans. Mike, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you so much, and I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Emily Toth is the Robert Penn Warren Professor of English and Women's Studies at Louisiana State University and the author of 11 books, including 5 on K. Chopin. Her biography, Unveiling K. Chopin, is widely considered to be the definitive work on this writer. In this 125th anniversary year of K. Chopin's awakening, Emily is the perfect person to turn to in celebrating this Louisiana classic. Emily Toth, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
You've devoted so much of your professional life to The Awakening. Do you remember the first time you read it or how it struck you then?
Yeah, it was a very heightened portion of my life, or anybody's life at that time. I was at an anti-war march, an anti-Vietnam War, and a woman slipped me a book. And she said, of course that's exciting, of course. And she said, you should read this. So I thought, well...
Serious.
Yeah, it seemed like it was probably a forbidden book, so I thought, yeah, I should. And she went off to Colorado and to find herself. I've never found her again. But she gave me a copy of The Awakening, which I had never heard of. And I was just blown away by it. I had no idea that there was a writer in 1899 who was saying the things we were saying in the feisty stages of the women's movement.
So introduce us to this story of The Awakening.
Well, it's about a woman in New Orleans who is a wife and mom, and it's in her late 20s, and she discovers, she realizes she doesn't really like it very much. One thing she doesn't like is she has the pompous ass of a husband, but another, the summer of and then The Awakening takes place in Grand Isle, there's another man in her life. He turns out to be, well, we'll talk later about what he turns out to be, and he disappoints her because she can't substitute him. But what she's doing is really enacting the discontent that we didn't know then, in 1970, when I discovered The Awakening. We didn't know that the late 20s were a time of great crisis and existential angst and so on of women in general, especially women who were wives and mothers. Gail Sheehy, who wrote about that in Passages, hadn't written the book yet. The Awakening contained things that I had never seen anywhere else, the conflict between a marriage, trying to be traditional in marriage, and to have a career. And I was going through that right now at the point that I read The Awakening. I was in graduate school, but I wasn't sure that I wanted to devote myself to being an academic. So it hit me right at the time when it should, and I never looked back.
You were one of the leading figures in restoring her to the canon.
Oh, yeah.
So talk about that process and the power of doing that for a book that you loved.
Yeah, there's a book about that, in fact, called The Awakenings. And it's about the Kate Chopin revival, which was really spearheaded by about four people, including Barbara Ewell in New Orleans. But all of us were about roughly the same age. We discovered The Awakening. All of us had crises in our life. Barbara had just left the convent. Bernie Kolaski, another one, had just left his marriage. So, yeah, we were all being a little bit therapized, I suppose, by the book. But I think what we wanted from the book was, well, we wanted a path, a writer who knew the path or knew, at least described the path that we were on ourselves. So independent of each other, because we didn't know each other then, all of us started writing about Chopin for academic publications, for popular publications. We started teaching The Awakening. I think it's the only example where the people actually rose up and got a book restored, a book that had been forgotten for 50 years, because we knew it said something to today's people.
So how do you feel when you read it now and you teach it now?
Yeah, well, it's different, of course, but the search for finding what you really care about in life is something that goes on forever.
Yeah.
And I was when I first read it in my 20s, I thought, well, maybe the search is for the right man or the right life partner. And I realized since then it isn't really. It's a search for yourself, as Kate Chopin says. And there are different ways you can find it, through careers, through teaching, through raising kids. And I think it's a great gift to women that we have the choices of different stages of life.
Mm-hmm.
And it means something different to me at each stage of life. In fact, that I've written actually two biographies of her. In the first one, I was preoccupied with whether Kate Chopin had an affair with another man. She did. But the second one, I was more preoccupied with trying to find out if she made a living as a writer.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. So I turned from romance to money. She did not make a living as a writer. Alas.
Well, one of the other things that struck me reading at this time was how much of New Orleans and Louisiana she captures in this short book. You know, you really get the feeling of streets and small restaurants and out-of-the-way places in New Orleans, and then you get the expanses of Grand Isle and the social mores of those summer vacations. And nature, so much nature in this book as well.
That was one of the things that made me fall in love with the book to begin with. I had never been to Louisiana.
How funny. It's hard to imagine Louisiana without you.
Yeah, I know. But I'd never been here until I'd written the dissertation, and I thought, well, I ought to check it out. And, you know, the rest was history.
So what are you going to be talking about when you're at the library?
Well, I gave him a title asking whether Kate Chopin was hilarious or morbid in her writings. And of course, she's both. But I want to point out that a really sophisticated, skilled writer, you can laugh at and cry at the same time. Mm-hmm. Her very short story that everybody reads in the first week of a short story course is a story of an hour.
Story of an hour, I know.
Yeah, of course. It takes about 20 minutes to read. It's actually faster. But it was a story about a woman who hears that her husband has been killed in a train crash. And then she's at first really sad. And then she realizes, well, hey, I'm going to be free to live my life as I will. And she's dancing around happy, and then she comes downstairs, and there's the door opening, and her husband is alive after all. Now, at that point, undergraduates who read the story start to laugh, and it's really an inappropriate laugh.
Yeah.
But that's Kate Chopin, and then it gets even funnier because, sort of, she sees her husband restored from the dead, And she drops dead. And the doctors say it was the joy that kills.
The joy that kills.
Yeah.
No wonder we've stuck with her all these years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of women who, in my classes, who can confess they really wish their husband's dead. But apart from that group, I think there's something funny, hilarious about the story that you don't get. It says you don't get what you want in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And Kate Chopin had her finger on that. I think that was part of her French heritage, too.
It's a very dark, modern sensibility.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
Also a very Louisiana kind of humor, too.
Yeah, I think so. I've been here now for 30 or 40 years, but when I first moved here, it was quite startling to me the things that people would laugh at, like dead bodies. And I laugh too. But yeah, there's something about Louisiana humor that's double-sided. I don't think there's totally devastating grief. There's grief, but there's also hope or humor in the tragedies of life.
And here we are still talking about her more than a century later. It's astonishing.
Yeah.
It's great. And thank you for bringing her back, Emily.
Oh, well, I'd bring her back again, but she's sprung.
You know? Yeah. We've been talking with LSU professor Emily Toth, the leading Kate Chopin scholar. You can meet her at 2:30 Saturday, August 17th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie when she discusses the social impact of Kate Chopin's The Awakening at the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association meeting. Everybody's welcome. Thanks so much, Emily. It was so good to hear your voice.
Yeah, well, thank you, Susan. You made this possible.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Melissa Jow presents a story time and signs her book, The Hesitant Hedgehog, Saturday, July 20th at 11 a.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Local poets will celebrate the life of Martha McFerrin by reading from her poetry Saturday, July 20th at 2 p.m. at the Old Metairie Library, 2350 Metairie Road. Alexandra Vasti signs her romance novel, Ne'er Duke Well, Saturday, July 20th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will hold a box sale of children's books and music CDs Saturday, July 27th from 9 to 4 or until sold out. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Boxes will be sold for $5 each, as well as boxes of music CDs. They're labeled as to what they contained, books or CDs, but cannot be opened prior to purchasing. Also coming up, to celebrate the publication of the 1619 Project in paperback, Baldwin & Company presents Nicole Hannah-Jones in conversation with Daniel Black, Saturday, July 27th at 4 at the Georges Auditorium at Dillard. Tickets are available at Eventbrite. And don't forget, during these dog days of summer, most of our public libraries are doing double duty as cooling centers. Get yourself a free library card, pick up some books, and cool off at the same time. Every year, Limnel invites submissions to its annual writing competition. Formerly the Words and Music Writing Competition, it's been rechristened the Patty Friedman Writing Competition. The categories are poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, public high school short story, and beyond the bars. That's a multi-genre competition for incarcerated juveniles. It's associated with the Words and Music Writers Conference that takes place in November each year. Winners are published in the 2025 Liminal Anthology, and all runners-up, finalists, and entrants will be considered for publication. Check out lmnlarts.com for complete info. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.